from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Red Ice Radio for the Seeker.
And welcome back to Red Ice Radio. Thank you for being here. I'm Henrik, and I hope you're having a good day and a good start to this June 2015. For newcomers, our website is redicecreations.com, where you can find a lot more of what we do, news, radio, videos, and more. We also have redicecreations.net, direct access to the radio archive, and redicemembers.com for our subscribers who enjoy getting the full broadcast and all the other members' content. We have Jim Fetzer with us today, a first-time guest, and also returning with us on the program is Ulle Dammegård once again. Mr. Fetzer is a former Marine Corps officer, a McKnight Professor Emeritus at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. He has published widely on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, and evolution and mentality. Well, I think you guys and gals know Ulle Dammegård by now if you are regular listeners, but for any newcomers, let me just mention that Ulle is an author, international speaker, investigator, former journalist, and artist who has spent at least 25 years investigating a multitude of conspiracies. He is behind the website Light on Conspiracies. And we are going to stay in the topic of conspiracy and cover-up today. We have an interesting program ahead on a new book of theirs called And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either. It's a collection of essays that is intended to challenge some of our most cherished and deeply held beliefs. Let me just read a portion here to you before we get to our guests. This book demonstrates with scientific argument and empirical proof that man did not go to the moon, that Paul McCartney was replaced after his death in 1966, and that the official narrative of the Holocaust cannot be sustained. It also explains how and why the United States hung one of its doubles, not the real Saddam Hussein, and that Osama bin Laden was not killed by U.S. Navy SEALs in Pakistan in 2011, but died from his medical conditions in 2001, where it was politically expedient for him to die a second time. Welcome, gentlemen. It's great to have you both here. And obviously, Ulle, you're a returning guest. We've had you many times now. As always, though, it's always great to have you with us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Henrik.
And, of course, we have with us Jim Fetzer as well. First time we have you on the program. It's good to have you here. Thank you for coming on.
Well, I've heard so many good things about Red Ice Radio, Henrik. I'm delighted to be here.
Thank you so much. Great to hear it. I mean, you've been, of course, doing what you've been doing for a long time. It's good to finally have you here, connect with you, and I'm looking forward to speaking more about your work as well, Jim, here. But as a way of kind of beginning this program here, why don't we just kind of start with you, Jim, before we dive into the book. I want to hear a little bit more about you. I know that you're a former Marine Corps officer. You were a professor at the University of Minnesota, Duluth. How did you end up writing it on the subjects we'll speak more about here today?
Yes, I graduated from Princeton magna cum laude in philosophy and was commissioned a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. I resigned my commission after 4 years as a captain to enter graduate school and earn my PhD in the history and the philosophy of science. And from 1970 to 2006, I taught at a wide range of colleges and universities around the country, principally courses in logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning. I became very interested in JFK in 1992. When I discovered that the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association was attacking everyone who'd ever done serious work on the assassination, many very prominent figures, and I knew that he was thereby abusing his position as an editor, where I had a great deal of editorial experience myself. I was 10 years an associate editor with Synthes, a very famous international journal for epistemology, methodology, and the philosophy of science. I would subsequently found my own journal, an international journal for artificial intelligence, philosophy, and cognitive science entitled Minds and Machines. So it was very clear to me that this was an abuse. And it struck me that if someone of his degree of prominence were to be politically abusing his position, perhaps some of us with special backgrounds and abilities ought to become involved in research here. I contacted a fellow who'd authored a letter to the American Medical Association, to the journal known colloquially as JAMA, J-A-M-A, where I liked what he had to say. He had both a PhD and an MD. It turned out in physics, MD, and he was a board certified in radiation oncology, which, of course, is a treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy. His name is David W. Mantic. And I suggested to him that we collaborate on a long article or a short book. Several others joined us, including a world authority on the human brain, who is also an expert on wound ballistics, a PhD in physics from Australia, who is an expert in electromagnetism, the properties of light and images of moving objects, a physician who'd been present in trauma room one when JFK was brought in, and then 2 days later was responsible for the treatment of his alleged assassin, Lee Oswald, the legendary photo and film analyst. We redid the case from the bottom up, went back to the official x-rays and the autopsy report and so forth, and discovered the x-rays had been altered, the autopsy report had been revised, that they'd even substituted someone else's brain, because once they patched up a fist-sized hole in the back of JFK's head, there was nowhere for those brains to go. I could have drawn that conclusion because it's a virtually intact brain when JFK had about half his brains blown out in Dealey Plaza, but it was nice to come from a world authority on the human brain. I would wind up chairing or co-chairing 5 different national conferences on JFK, published my first book, a collection of expert studies, including by Mantic and others, including Bob Livingston, who was the world authority on the human brain, who was the scientific director of 2 institutes of the National Institute for Health, which are located across the street from Bethesda Naval Hospital. Really fascinating stuff. It's entitled Assassination Science 1998. I organized a conference in Minneapolis in 1999 on the death of JFK, published a second book entitled Murder in Dealey Plaza in 2000, and then had a conference on the Duluth campus about the Zapruder film specifically, because we had so many indications the film had been massively revised, and that was published in the Great Zapruder Film Hoax in 2003.
Yeah.
I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005, Henrik, and I don't know if the university would have been supportive in my research on 9/11 as it was on JFK, where I believe I had an advantage because there was a member of the graduate faculty, the administration, and the Twin Cities campus who really liked my work. So, you know, while many colleges and universities take a dim view of their faculty becoming involved in these complex and controversial issues, my opinion is nothing could be more appropriate.
Yeah.
And I think it was a rather natural extension of my research from that point on, especially on 9/11, but subsequently on Sandy Hook, on the Boston bombing, currently on Jade Helm, and where this book was kind of a natural extension. Because so much of what we're dealing with here involves lies from the government, and some of the biggest lies we've heard from the government are ones that are addressed in this particular volume.
Well, exactly. The title is, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. So obviously, it's a collection of essays with a lot of different authors. You guys are editors, have been doing the layout, etc. And there's a lot of different topics in there. I don't know if it would be fair to kind of call it a one-stop shop of all the things we're not supposed to know about, but how did the book come together, guys? Whoever want to pick up on that?
Well, here's a nice summary from the back page that gives a theme of the book and some of the tenor. William Casey, director of the CIA, was reported to have told his staff, "Our disinformation campaign will be a success when everything the American people believe is false." And they seem to have done a pretty good job of it, where this book explains how we know that we did not go to the moon but faked it, that Paul McCartney died and was replaced, that we hung a double, not Saddam, that Osama died in Afghanistan, not Pakistan, that the Holocaust was different than historians claim, where this book challenges some of our most cherished and deeply held beliefs, but the authors have no axe to grind, and unlike the parties to these frauds, are only committed to exposing the truth.
Yeah.
To be more specific with you, Ole, Mike Palachek envisioned having a series of books entitled Resist the Empire, Save the World, the first of which was actually a study of me and of Kevin Barrett, a colleague with whom I had a radio show on the Genesis Communication Network for a year and a half entitled The Dynamic Duo. So he used the title The Dynamic Duo, and it turned out to be a monster book about the size of a small phone directory. But we wanted to do one also on Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing, both of which were elaborate frauds. Nobody died at Sandy Hook or at the Boston bombing. I've done a huge amount of research on this. That was actually originally intended to be published before this one, which leads to the title, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either after learning that nobody died at Sandy Hook. But because of production problems on that book, this one has come out first and actually been beneficial because it enables me to re-edit the earlier book with much more recent and actually more important articles than many we had in the earlier version. And there will be a sequel here about the nuclear attack on New York on 9/11 because most Americans have no idea how it was done, who was responsible or why. So the final volume in the four book series will be on 9/11.
Very good. There's a lot of different topics here, obviously, to dive into and to talk more about. And obviously the most controversial has to be the Holocaust issue. And I definitely want to talk more in detail about that a little bit later, but let's just kind of speak about the main subject first of the book, or I don't know if it is the main subject, but it's the first one and it addressed in the title of the moon, of course. Just tell us, when and how you first, Jim, and then we can switch over to you, Ulla, this is a topic that deserves the title of the book, in your opinion, Jim?
Well, it's very interesting because in 2001, I had made my second trip to London and brought my wife. I'd been there before to give the keynote address at the annual meeting of the British Society for the Philosophy of Science at the London School of Economics. And I loved London so much, I knew Jan and Sarah would be thrilled. So next time I brought them with me, and Jan and I, her maiden name was Morgan. So when I was looking for a suitable place, I found on Bloomsbury Street, the Morgan Hotel, which backs onto the British Museum. So I booked us there, and we were watching one of the BBC channels when, to my astonishment, they played conspiracy theory, did we land on the moon? And I was utterly captivated. I'd say from that point on, I took a keen interest. And on my own radio show, which was more recently on Revere Radio with 882-hour interviews on complex and controversial issues, I did several about the moon landings, including with Jay Wiedner, who, of course, is a contributor to the present book. And, you know, it was just a matter of putting all the pieces together, where Winston Wu turns out to be an absolute genius in his analysis of the moon landing. And one of the key chapters there is by Winston entitled The Apollo Moon Hoax, 35 Proofs We Did Not Go. I would just add, Heinrich, that we have 100 pages on the moon landing. We have 100 pages on Paul McCartney, and the importance of that will emerge. Then we have 50 pages discussing Saddam Hussein and his replacement by a double, and another 50 on Osama and the faking of his second death in Pakistan. And then the final 50 pages are on the Holocaust, the mythology of World War II. And I must say, in my opinion, those are probably the 50 most powerful pages ever published on the Holocaust.
Interesting. Yeah, I definitely want to hear more about that. But maybe you want to, I mean, we've spoken, of course, about the moon issue, if you will, in the past, and many people have different opinions, different angles to this and whatnot. But tell us how you guys approached the subject. And again, there's so much to dive into. And so obviously at some point, there's a selected material that you have to go for. So what, give us some of the evidence that we didn't go to the moon.
Well, we can begin with a vast number of anomalies in the moon photographs, the very existence of which is questionable in and of itself for multiple reasons. But where, for example, you find photographs with two sources of light, so shadows are cast in two different directions. you find the astronauts illuminated on the dark side of the moon lander, where they should be in the dark, but they're not. They're illuminated. We have moon rover photographs with no tracks in front or behind. So how did the moon lander, the moon rover, get into that position? We have photographs of the moon lander after it's landed, but there's no blown out dust beneath the jets, which would have invariably occurred had it actually come down as claimed, and no dust on the landing pods either. I mean, there's a whole lot more, but that'll give you just an inkling of the idea of what we were uncovering. Well, which includes, by the way, a fascinating calculation by Jack White. This was the celebrated film and photography expert who I became acquainted with. We became close colleagues in relation to JFK research, where he had discovered one oddity after another, and many indications the Zapruder film had been altered and the backyard photographs of Lee Oswald had been faked and so forth. But here in this instance, he had a website, which you can find online for, you know, Jack White's Apollo moons photo studies. And one of the most interesting, apart from, you know, the detailed features of the specific photographs, is the following. He discovered, he added up how many photographs had been taken during the various moon landings, the 6, 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17. And he found that altogether there were 5,771 photographs that had been taken in 4,834 minutes. Now, he wrote, if nothing but photography had been done, such a feat is clearly impossible, made even more so by all the documented activities of the astronauts. Imagine 1.19 photos every minute that men were on the moon. That's one picture every 50 seconds. The secret NSA tried to hide has been discovered. The quantity of photographs purporting to record the Apollo lunar EVAs could not have been taken on the moon in such an impossible time frame. So why did these photos exist? How did these photos get made? Did any men go to the moon, or was it truly the greatest hoax ever, where the other evidence we amassed together with this established that, without any doubt, it is the greatest hoax ever?
So let's speak about Wernher von Braun a little bit, because that obviously connects us with the whole, with the Second World War. He was shipped off to the USA after Germany had been destroyed. And so did he, how much would you say he contributed to the US space program? Or is it, obviously there's a difference here, meaning, it's not indicative of the fact that man didn't go into space, but it's a detail of whether, when and or even how we landed on the moon. Is that a correct assessment?
Yes. Well, Wernher was brought over to the U.S. as a part of Operation Paperclip, where many of the Germany's best scientists and intelligence officials were incorporated into the American intelligence establishment, where even NASA, it turns out, is apparently a branch of the CIA. Now, the United States had been embarrassed by Sputnik, where the Russians got a satellite into space ahead of the U.S., suggesting they had technological and scientific superiority. So JFK declared that we had the mission to put a man on the moon. Now, I believe that if JFK had lived and had been informed of the insuperable scientific obstacles, including, for example, the Van Allen radiation belt, where NASA has recently acknowledged that the greatest obstacle to a manned mission to Mars is overcoming the Van Allen radiation belt, which is fantastic. I mean, they issued this announcement on 30 August 2012, when the Van Allen radiation belt is nothing new. It's been here since Earth was formed. So, you know, I mean, the idea that if that would inhibit a manned mission to Mars, it would also inhibit a manned mission to the moon. So they didn't realize quite how much they were conceding. Now, Wernher von Braun became involved in all of this. He designed a spaceship to go to the moon that was like three times larger than the Empire State Building. And he said we'd need several of them. But I believe when it became technologically, obvious, this was scientifically impossible, that he participated in the cover-up, including conducting trip to Antarctica that appears to have been done to collect moon rocks that had been dislodged from Earth's surface by the impact of small asteroids and caught in the Earth's gravitational field, so that they were brought down into that region of Earth so that they could actually produce rocks that were bona fide moon rocks. They simply hadn't got to Earth the way claimed aboard a spaceship. Those were conducted in the local summer of 1966-67 and appears to have been a part of it. But all the techniques that were used here to create the fakery were well captured in a number of films, but especially perhaps Capricorn 1, which was about faking a trip to Mars that includes several famous actors, including even O.J. Simpson before his disgrace over the murder of his ex-wife.
That's right.
And it showed the use of a very grainy single-source feed. I mean, all of this appears to have been done on a set. Stanley Kubrick appears to have created the images for use, and in return, he was given funding for his Space Odyssey 2001. Jay Wiedner has been right on top of this and published a marvelous article explaining how it was done using what is known as front screen projection.
Yep, exactly. I remember in, I think it was 2009, it came out that some of the moon rocks that was given to Holland, by the way, by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin, turned out to be fake.
Yeah, it turned out to be a piece of petrified wood.
Yeah, interesting, huh?
But Heinrich, that's so embarrassing and so amateurish. Would you believe now NASA recently acknowledged that it had lost all of its original moon travel landing footage,
yes,
which is astonishing. Yeah. I mean, you know, some 7 boxes, Heinrich. This had to be the most precious footage ever acquired by the hand of man, assuming, of course, that these trips actually took place. But I think it's very clear that in order for anomalies, you know, and the fakery of the footage to be discovered, they prefer to simply, you know, dispose of it, claim it was lost, which is utterly preposterous on the face of it. And I'm given to understand that they're going through and selectively deleting other moon landing photographs even as we speak.
Now, let me try to poke at this a little bit here and ask you guys how you explain the lunar laser ranging experiments and the I would say alleged, because I haven't looked into this in much detail, to be honest, about this particular thing. But obviously, what we hear is that we had mirrors placed on the moon. There are distance measurements and these kinds of things made with lasers all the time. How is this explained?
By unmanned landings. I mean, there's no doubt we've sent lunar probes to the surface of the moon. No one was live aboard them to risk exposure to radiation, which the astronauts' spacesuits would not have prevented. They basically were costumes intended to create the impression. You can go back to, you know, all kinds of science fiction films and television programs we've had over the decades, and you'll see similarly flimsy costumes. So, you know, the reflections, I think, aren't in doubt, and that they were implanted by, you know, these unmanned landings, which may have landed robotic equipment there to emplace them. So that really is doubt, and most certainly does not show that man went to the moon.
Right. Okay, that's good. I want to make that distinction, because obviously it seems there's a lot of things that have been successful. But we're talking about probes and things like that, and it's a huge difference, as you say, to actually land a human being there, and the way it suggests that it was taken. I know that other people too have suggested that actually we did go to the moon, but not in the way that we are told. Is that anything you guys touch
upon? Heinrich, it reaches a point of it's what Imre Lakatos described as a degenerating research paradigm. You have a hardcore and you want to defend it regardless, so you start jettisoning and replacing auxiliary hypotheses about the evidence and so forth. Well, yes, they faked all the photographs, but that's because they had to conceal something more important. We never know what it is that's more important. We are never provided with any proof that we actually went to the moon. And just to make an observation about the features, the gross features of the moon photographs, these cameras were situated on the front of the astronauts' suits. They could not even be focused or framed. They could certainly turn, point, and take. Now, under those circumstances, you'd expect a whole lot of photographs that would be out of focus or not properly framed and so forth. That's not what we have. Every single moon photograph seems somehow miraculously to have been properly framed, properly photographed, properly focused. One of the points that Jay Wiedner makes, of course, about the foreground and the background is ordinarily they would not both be in focus, and it's an indication of the use of front screen projection that you have the background in the distance just as sharply in focus as the foreground. My own opinion is cosmic rays would interfere with the photographic plates, and it would have been impossible to take any photographs on the moon. But the signs of, that this was all fabricated and faked are simply overwhelming. And I don't think we can get away with some suggestion that it was, actually they faked what they gave us to conceal what they didn't give us. You still can't overcome the insuperable objection posed even by the Van Allen radiation belt, which NASA itself has confirmed.
Ula, have you looked into the subject a lot yourself?
A lot, I wouldn't say so, but I've always been very interested because it's so clear if you just look at it with a normal sense of logic that once you look into the details and the evidence, there's something extremely wrong and there's a lot of forgery going on. One thing that has really got me interested in this is that when I started out in the early 80s with these things, I had no idea that there were any type of connection between different assassinations or something. I thought they were totally separate things. But when you really go into deep into history, you will find that we have the same key players behind so many of these atrocities that the world have experienced, and the same key players like masters of manipulation. I mean, you've got Donald Rumsfeld, you've got Henry Kissinger, you've got the Bush family, the Dulles brothers. I mean, everything, they've been involved in everything from the fake Zimmerman telegram that got the U.S. into the First World War. That was Prescott Bush. Then you had Prescott Bush doing the funneling a lot of the funds to Hitler. You had the Dulles brothers that was working at Wall Street lawyers but working for Hitler. Then Alan Dulles was in charge or very involved in Operation Paperclip, where they exported all of these Nazi scientists and very, very skilled people in so many different areas, where these people were part of building up and creating what is now called NASA, or it was called that right away, but that was built up together with people from the OSS, later the CIA, Alan Dulles, and German scientists, among other things. They were also, as far as I've been able to find out, part of creating what is called the CDC. That was in 1946, the Center for Disease Control. And that is the one that is now so central. Every time they have one of these swine flu or the Ebola scare or whatever it is they're trying to scare the living bejesus out of it, they're using these organizations. And then you go through, you see the Kennedy assassination. We have the same players involved there, George Bush, the paymaster for Operation 40, which was deeply involved in the assassination, Alan Dulles, part of the planning and also part of the cover-up in the Warren Commission. Then it just goes on and on. You have the overtake of all of these countries in Latin America with Henry Kissinger and the creation of the Contras and the whole Iran-Contra scandal, same key players. You have Operation Phoenix in this assassination program in Vietnam, and all it's the same people again and again and again and again and again and again. It's just like incredible. So I think one of the things that is so wonderful with these books is that they're pulling it back together, showing that, listen, we're not living in a totally mad world. We're living in a world where there's hardly any evidence for real terrorism. We're living in a world where we're being totally manipulated on so many different layers and with so many different fake events. I mean, they're fake. So I think this is beautiful when they get exposed, because it's like it helps us take our power back, because we've lost it. We've given it up to this elite few, as they call themselves, and we're letting us be totally duped. So I think books like this, extremely important, even though we go right for in the belly of the beast, especially when it comes to the Holocaust thing, which is so many people have, or the people who have had the guts to expose these things, most of them have gone down in flames. Their career has been totally destroyed. They've ended up in jail. I mean, it's still like that. In some, you, Henrik, me, Jim, if we were in Germany now, we would be arrested. Or if this discussion or the programs that I was on before this book was published in Germany, we would go straight to jail. And Germany, of all countries, it's so absurd. The whole thing is so absurd.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I wanted to squeeze in, if you will. Well, we have plenty of time to go here in the first segment, of course, but I did want to get into the Holocaust here in the first segment so we can get to some of that, because it's just such an important area. It's very controversial, and some of the authors you feature in the book about this is, among others, Professor Robert Faurisson, for example, from France, I believe, and he has been, I mean, God, I looked at some footage the other day of him. He's gotten his, you know, face, you know, beat up, or beaten in, I guess that's the term, and some tremendous violence aimed at him for asking some of these questions. You feature Thomas Dalton, and Jim, tell us just when and how and why did you want to go into this particular area when there's so much controversy and so much anger and emotion and everything you can imagine around this topic?
Well, I first became serious about it when an associate of mine in Illinois proposed having a conference on academic freedom. Are there limits to inquiry? And we settled on JFK, 9/11, and the Holocaust as examples that would perfectly illustrate the situation, where most academicians are simply too timid. They want to avoid any form of embarrassment. They don't want a student to ask a question they can't answer. They don't want to be called out for something that they might regard as beyond their own competence. So they play it safe, and they just don't go there, which has led to the absurdity that the very faculty whose tenure ensures that they can tackle complex and controversial issues confronting society without fear of loss of their positions are nevertheless among the most timid and unwilling to explore these issues. In the setting up that conference, I made contact with several an attorney who is very active in First Amendment cases, a member of the AAUP who is outspoken in defense of academic freedom, and they wouldn't participate. They weren't willing to go there. They weren't willing to talk about these issues. So I became more deeply involved, and in the course of my research of preparing my own presentation, I discovered at that time that the number 6 million did not have an empirical or historical basis, but that there had been 236 references to 6 million Jews who were either in dire straits or in fear of their lives before the Nuremberg tribunals, beginning as early as 1890. Thomas Dalton has suggested there are some even before that point in time. But I presented a dozen or more examples during the conference, which was actually on the campus of the University of Illinois Champaign-Urbana. And when I returned from that, where Nicholas Kohlerstrom, by the way, who also contributed an article.
That's right.
Here,
I forgot. He's
published
great.
This brilliant new book called Breaking the Spell, participated with us on Skype, for example. And what would you believe, when I returned home, I checked and my wiki entry had been gutted. It used to be very, very substantial, a tremendous amount about all my research on JFK, 9/11, the plane crash that took the life of Senator Paul Wellstone, Sandy Hook, the Boston bombing, claims I was anti-Semitic that I dispatched in an early article entitled "Is 9/11 Research Anti-Semitic?" and the like. And Heinrich, they'd taken out 2/3 of the entry. They've taken everything about all my serious research on what is usually called conspiracies, but where really the label conspiracy theorist is used to try to categorize and dismiss serious critics of the government. I mean, most conspiracy theorists really fall into the category of being those who are exposing government lies. So the government has to take some action to defend itself in introducing a novel phrase or expression which originated with the CIA. In response to criticism that was being directed at the Warren Commission, they devised this phrase, conspiracy theorists. one interview I did with a major radio station, WCCO in Minneapolis, on my way to a conference on JFK just this past year, I explained that better terms are conspiracy realist or even conspiracy analyst. But the fact of the matter is we're simply critics of the government. We're exposing falsehoods and revealing truths, and the government does not like it. So, I mean, that's got a whole lot to do with what's going on here. Interestingly, I happen to have a recent copy of my Wikipedia entry. So I published an article about it entitled James Henry Fetzer, Wikipedia, the Free Encyclopedia Busted, where I published the current version that was edited after I participated in the Academic Freedom Conference and the original to show how much they had taken out. And although I encountered the bizarre experience a month or so ago of having 150 articles I'd published on Veterans Today deleted by the senior editor, deleted 150 articles I'd published there since 5 July 2011, because I was speaking out about Jade Helm and he wanted to suppress it, I nevertheless was able to reconstruct that article. I had a copy that had been published in toto on another website. So you can find it now several places, including my own personal blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and on the new website for veterans entitled veteranstruthnetwork.com. But if you want to see how Wikipedia functions as a Zionist political operation, while it's perfectly reliable on relatively routine or uncontroversial issues about science, history, the meaning of words, and so forth, it's twisted or perverted when it comes to politically controversial issues, as my case illustrates. Indeed, I mentioned that I'd founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in 2005. Well, I discovered Wikipedia had entries about scholars that were grossly inaccurate. So I went onto Wikipedia. You know how they claim anyone can edit Wikipedia.
Yeah, well, that's over.
Yeah, I tried a half a dozen times to correct it, and every time I was rebuffed and it was reverted to the original.
Of course.
And I finally got into a chat with a person who was not allowing. I said, "You're not going to let me correct this, are you?" And he said, "No."
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was just illustrative. I actually published an article about that, too. But I don't know if I have reconstructed it yet or not. But in any case, this is a highly illustrative case. And that reinforced my interest in the Holocaust. And I did more research on it when Nick published, before he published his book, he invited me to write the preface to the book, which I was very honored to do. And I published it even as an independent article on Veterans Today. It's one of the 150 that's since been deleted. But in fact, I was able to recapture that too. And that's what you find in my contribution to part four on the Holocaust, where I'm summarizing not only that we have these 236 references to 6 million Jews in distress or in fear of loss of their lives before the Nuremberg Tribunal, but the fact that this whole number 6 million appears to be derived from a disputed passage in Leviticus that's been interpreted to mean that the chosen people can only return to the promised land when they're minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flames. And even that number requires an interpolation because there was no 6 million, numeral in the language in which it was originally written. So this is all a matter of interpretation and reconstruction. In fact, the International Committee of the Red Cross did very thorough, meticulous records. They were visiting all the camps, and they kept dates, cause of death for all the deaths. And in 1993, they updated, and their total was 296,081 that had died from all causes. In fact, it's interesting, Heinrich, more Catholics than Jews died in Auschwitz.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I mean, when you go into this area, it's just you can't go in there. I mean, obviously, and if you do, your character needs to be destroyed to at any means necessary. I mean, okay, there's one thing with the establishment per se and their view on this, and of course their mouthpieces like the mainstream media and Wikipedia and all these sources. But from your audience point of view, Jim, I guess more just on a personal note, were they angry and upset with you that you wanted to touch on this and this is like going too far, or were they willing to listen to what you had to say about it?
Oh, no. The book's been a huge success. Actually, believe it or not, Amazon has over 2 million books, and our book already is above 1,888 on the bestseller list in terms of number of volumes sold over a period of time. I think a lot of people recognize the importance of what we're doing for the following reason, Heinrich. What Nick did was to reveal scientific evidence that the Holocaust story of 6 million Jews being gassed to death in chambers using Zyklon B was unsustainable on the basis of laws of material science and of biochemistry. And because Nick is an historian of science, because my PhD is in the history and philosophy of science, I was very impressed. I have done a lot of work on the theoretical foundations of scientific knowledge, computer science, artificial intelligence, cognitive science, evolution and mentality, the nature of laws, the nature of scientific explanations, the nature of scientific reasoning generally. Any reasoning involving laws of science established by the different science, physics, chemistry, biology, and so forth is scientific reasoning. And in this case, what Nick discovered was that as a principle, a law of biochemistry, that bodies that die from cyanide poisoning, where Zyklon B is a form of cyanide, their bodies turn pink. And the walls of chambers where Zyklon B is used turn, because of the interaction with the elements in the wall, they turn blue. But we have no reports of pink bodies from any of the camps. We've never had them. And the only walls that turn blue were in chambers that were being used for delousing, which is something that was going on in the camps to keep the inmates well. It was a matter of hygiene and sanitation to keep diseases like typhus from spreading, which are done by body lice. So they used quite a copious quantity of Zyklon B, but it was for delousing, which led Nick to observe that the quickest way to lose your appointment at a British museum is to raise questions about the delousing technology used by the Germans in World War II.
Yeah.
Because he was booted out of University College London, where he'd had a post for some 11 years merely by publishing articles about objective scientific evidence that the official narrative of the Holocaust cannot possibly be true. And to make one terribly important observation, Gilad Atzmon, whom I featured as the third of my speakers when I organized the first international conference for scholars for 9/11 truth at Friends House in London in 2010, has come here to Madison twice. He was here just a week or so ago, and it was my great pleasure to see him again. But when he visited here about a year ago, before I gave a talk about Jewish identity politics, and it struck me just unbelievably clearly how the Holocaust story has been used to play on a Western sense of guilt in order to manipulate these nations to making way, giving way, giving Israel preference because they feel responsible for the death of 6 million Jews. The fact of the matter is it did not happen. Many Jews died. Millions died in World War II. It was chaotic. It was calamitous. But The official Holocaust narrative of 6 million Jews having died in gas chambers using Zyklon B is not only false, it's refutable on the basis of scientific reasoning.
Well, exactly. We have to be able to look into these questions, of course, and I think it's good that people do, no matter what initially some of the consequences for this might be. It's just too important to stay away from because so much hinge on this piece of history. And as you say, the consequent behavior of what we see happening in Palestine and even, as you rightly say, in Europe as well, this extortion of sorts of guilt and allowing this. And just look at the money question in itself. Countless money, and United States who fought to destroy the enemy that allegedly did all this, even they to a certain extent have to suffer as Britain has done, which is very strange, isn't it?
You're absolutely right, Heinrich, and it's my feeling. This has always been my attitude about the Holocaust. If it was real, then serious research would support it. And if it was not, then the world deserves to know. It's not, and the world does deserve to know.
Let's just talk about join in, Ola, please.
No, I just wanted to say that, Henrik, we did a almost 2-hour long interview very recently where we went into extreme details about the Holocaust just by using normal Farmer Brown logic. At least that's the way I see it. You look at the evidence, you go where it takes you, wherever the truth will take you, you have to have the courage to go there. And when you go into this topic, it's just unreal how things does not add up at all. I mean, it does not make sense at all. how these gas chambers were built. When you look at the construction of them, they did not work. They did not function the way we're being told. Like some blinker, they used diesel engines to gas people. You look at scientific proof, you cannot kill someone with diesel exhaust. You can get very sick and so on, but you won't die from it. And so it's just the chimneys to the gas chambers were not connected to the rooms where they said the gassing took place and so on. So it just doesn't match up. And after I did this, I was a bit nervous to do this interview,
right.
the last one, because I've seen other people go down. I get totally massacred when they go into this topic. But the response I've got from listeners have been absolutely overwhelming, where people have just said, my God, it's wonderful that you guys have the courage to go where very few other people go. Mm. And also because it will liberate us all, because this is being used as such a weapon against truth seekers in all different areas around this whole power structure that is trying to control the world today. And I'm about to leave for the Open Mind Conference in Amsterdam in a few days, and I'm going there speaking about false flag operations and so on. I'm joined by some beautiful people who are also doing everything they can to expose the truth. And the media in Holland, I've just been told, have gone out big time saying that this is a big rally for anti-Semites.
Oh, really? There you go.
And Nazis and, yep, and stuff like, and it's like, that is the last thing. I don't even step on ants, you know. I can, with respect and love to my fellow human being. It's just totally absurd, but this is the weapon they hit you with as soon
exactly.
as you even point a finger. I'm not here to attack anyone. I'm here to see what is the truth. What is the truth? Because once again, it is being used as soon as somebody starts really digging into to something, might it be 9/11 or other things, this thing, anti-Semite, comes up. What is that?
Yeah.
You know, it has nothing to do. We're looking for the truth.
Heinrich,
yeah,
those who challenge the Holocaust narrative are invariably denounced as anti-Semites and as Holocaust deniers who are spreading hate speech. But anti-Semites disvalue or discount the value or worth of persons or their opinions on the basis of their religious orientation or their ethnic origins. None of us who have contributed to this book do that, which means that we are not anti-Semites. Hate speech can be defined as any speech, gesture, or conduct, writing, or display, which is forbidden because it may incite violence or prejudicial action against or by a protected individual or group, or because it disparages or intimidates a protected individual or group. But we don't do that either. Unless accurately reporting the results of scientific research on a major historical event qualifies as hate speech, which means we face the choice of either not reporting the results of scientific research on a major historical event or risking being accused of hate speech. In sorting out some of the most complex and controversial issues of our time, especially this one, therefore, we take the stand that truth is preferable to mythology.
Well, there is that quote, right? The truth is only hate speech for those who hate the truth. And that's kind of,
yes,
and that's where we're at right now, you know, because obviously science doesn't matter, you know, I mean, it matters to those who want to know the truth, but it doesn't matter to people who need this to be in a certain way for things to click on the, not only geopolitical level, but emotional level, et cetera. And that's why, many people then don't look at the evidence and they don't look at where this leads you, because obviously there's, if a media rally is starting up in this way, there really isn't any defense against that, because they will never hear your side of the story. Thank God though, we have the web, we can talk with each other, we can get this out. But what would you guys say to that in terms of trying to legitimize this question to the mainstream?
It reflects the Zionist domination of the media. Even in the Netherlands, I mean, this is disgraceful, but, you know, the insidious influence here of those who are promoting the Holocaust agenda is breathtaking in its scope. And we must learn to repudiate this propaganda source, because it's ubiquitous You would find similar claims, no doubt, in the New York Times or the Washington Post. You can get more truth from Pravda or Russia Today than you can in the major media in the United States today. It's an appalling situation, Heinrich, especially given that this country, meaning the United States, was founded on principles of free speech, a free press, you know, unfettered discussion, open exchange, and yet it has become a mere shadow of its former self. There was once a time, I think, when there was a great deal of freedom of speech, and we had genuine, bona fide investigative journalism, but it appears to be a figment of a distant past.
Well, exactly. And I would say at this stage, it's interesting because now it's gone so far so that it's come to one of these kinds of subjects where the media, I think, will never budge. The authorities, the official explanations will never budge. But that in itself lends itself to discrediting its own behavior. And I think that's one of the reasons why the media is kind of faltering in listenership, readership, viewership, all of that, that more and more people are seeking the answers elsewhere. Right?
Yes. Yes, we had a recent study here in the U.S. showing 55% of the American people prefer the alternative media to the mainstream media.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, if anyone actually looks at the evidence, that's all I ask. Look at the evidence. This book is chock full of evidence, maps, drawings, photographs, diagrams, all the data you can possibly need. There's more than sufficient evidence to prove each of the key points toward which this book is devoted. I mean, there's just no room for doubt left about it. No alternative position is reasonable once you look at all the evidence. So the challenge is to get people to look at the evidence, which is why the propaganda campaign is so vicious and comprehensive. They don't want anyone to look at the evidence. Think of something as trifling as a map of Auschwitz, Heinrich. If you look at a map of Auschwitz, you find it has all sorts of facilities that are inconsistent with it having been a center for extermination. It includes a hospital with OBGYN facilities, a woodworking shop for making furniture and artifacts, an area for the symphony to play, orchestra performance. It even has a brothel, Heinrich. I therefore had, you know, featured a photograph on the back cover of the book of the British football team at Auschwitz with the caption, "What? You didn't know there was a UK soccer team at Auschwitz?"
Yep, I saw the back cover, and that's the kind of information, of course, that people. I mean, the thing is, though, I feel anyway that the view that we've gotten is so unbalanced, so that when these kinds of tidbit of information that comes out, they leave you kind of in a shocked state almost of like what? Because this was the epitome of evil. This is the time when, you know, Satan incarnate visited the earth, and the good forces in the world had to come together to fight them, to clear this out, so to speak. But when these kinds of things come up with the orchestras and swimming pools and football teams, and that's completely contradictory to what we've been told.
Yes, you're absolutely right, and it's just stunning the extent to which the quality of news coverage, not just in the U.S. but around the world, has deteriorated. So that is the alternative news source. It's like Press TV. I've probably given 100 interviews to Press TV or Al Jazeera or The Voice of Russia, for example. Voice of Russia recently interviewed Nathan Folks, who's a Hollywood producer director, about the Boston bombing, where Nathan identified one of the key players wearing a cowboy hat as an actor he cast in one of his own films. His name was Carlos Arredondo. You can see footage of Carlos waiting around until it's his time to follow the script and become involved. You have smoke and you have bodies with missing body parts, but there is no blood. Lorraine Day, who was the head of trauma surgery for San Francisco General Hospital, has observed that's a physiological impossibility. The blood only shows up later, and it's fake blood, Hollywood blood. It came out of tubes. And in fact, it's Nathan's opinion that it wasn't even an explosion that caused the smoke, that it was done by a smoke machine. And he, as a producer-director, is more knowledgeable about aspects of this than am I. And he observed that it's what's known as hyper-realistic filming, where you try to make a scene as realistic as possible so that you can expose, for example, inexperienced troops to what they might encounter in combat. But it's all fake. Nobody died at the Boston bombing. I published quite a lot about it, including on YouTube. I have both a an introduction to Sandy Hook and to the Boston bombing. They're entitled the Real Deal Special Must-See Sandy Hook Update and the Real Deal Special Must-See Boston Bombing. And I recently interviewed the aunt of the two brothers who were accused, Marette Sarinoff, and published an article on my blog and on Veterans Truth Network entitled "They Didn't Do It." Marette Sarinoff blows apart the Boston show trial, where she demonstrates that even the footage of the boys at the marathon itself was fake, because Tamerlan, the older brother, already had a beard, and yet he's clean shaven at the marathon. She sent me a photograph of him in bed with his cat. He's got a beard, a video from a gymnasium working out with Zoker. He's got a beard. A friend called him after the bombing was relieved. He hadn't been anywhere in the vicinity. They had dinner together that night. He had a beard. In the arrest footage, if it hasn't been fuzzied up, which they're doing, you can see he's still got a beard. And the photograph of his body lying lifeless, he has a beard, but he's clean shaven in the marathon footage. Not only that, but I involved an attorney at law, a former law professor who'd been both a prosecutor and a defense attorney, to review the case. And he pointed out that in the FBI indictment, in the formal indictment in court and in the FBI investigative report, they both state that the backpacks that exploded were black nylon backpack. But neither of the brothers was wearing a black nylon backpack. In fact, those were being worn by Kraft International personnel, whom the alternative media zoomed in on already the night of the event and exposed them as having planted these backpacks that exploded. And where this means, according to the former professor, his name is John Remington Graham, that there wasn't even probable cause to arrest or indict them, much less to convict them in a court of law. And a third point made in that interview with Marette is that Tamerlan was, of course, found dead after the police had arrested him. I mean, how could his brother Zoker have possibly killed him by driving him over with an SUV, apparently Tamerlan's own vehicle, after the police had arrested him? But Americans are so slow at putting two and two together, they don't even appreciate that. Well, here he's arrested, and then he turns up dead. How could his brother have been responsible for his death? In fact, we have a witness who reported seeing the police drive over him three different times with what appears to have been his own vehicle. I mean, it's that outrageous. I lay all this out in that article, "They Didn't Do It." Marette Sarinova blows apart the Boston show trial.
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of questions about these events, and it's very important that we ask them and dedicate some time looking at them, you know, especially when people like yourselves have done a lot of research on it, and also especially considering how we are supposed to react, or in what direction we should take, both geopolitically or surveillance wise or responses to these kinds of things. And that's why it is important. But gentlemen, we have much more to discuss, and I want to pick up in the second hour shortly here. We're going to take a break, but let us first give out some of the details, not only where people can get a copy of the book, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either. And of course the other volumes in the same series, if you will. I also want to give you gentlemen time to mention the websites that you have out there, so you guys listening know where to go if you want to find out more. Let's begin with you, Jim. Give us the details about the book.
With the book, there are two sources now. There will be more in the future, but right now you can obtain copies of the book at CreateSpace. Just put in, "And We Didn't Go to the Moon Either," CreateSpace, and you'll find one opportunity to obtain it, and the other is at Amazon.com. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, Amazon.com, and you'll find it there too. And it's also listed under Ole's books because he was so crucial in its production. So it's all, those are three different places. In fact, remarkably, Amazon is giving a 10% discount. So the book, we priced it low, $18.95, to make it accessible to one and all. I mean, it's over 365 pages, just stocked full of evidence, including an index, a contributors page, and all the rest that you'd expect. It's all there in a wonderful package with a marvelous cover. But Amazon is selling it for like $17 and a cent. I mean, it's remarkable to me that that's taking place, but I'm very pleased.
Yeah, they always manage to push down the price in some way. I've heard from so many authors, they don't know how they do that, but they do it somehow. But give us some of your websites as well, Jim.
Well, the key are going to be, I have a 9/11 website at 911scholars.org. I have an assassinationscience.com website. I have my personal blog, jamesfetzer.blogspot.com, and I am publishing also now, as I mentioned previously, at veteranstruthnetwork.com. So all of those are good places. Plus, I do the real deal. I do a new video show, just began this year, and we have over 62-hour video programs online, which you can find if you do a search on MBC, for Media Broadcasting Center, The Real Deal. And, you know, you should be able to find all 60 there one way or another. Also, you could go to webookyourshow.com and you'll find an archive for The Real Deal.
All right. We'll try to have as many of these links up as possible on our side. Of course, folks, you can find them easily from ours. Ulla, let's share some of your details as well, your website, your books, and also tell us about the upcoming conference, if you have that URL and whatnot.
Okay. My website is lightonconspiracies.com. Because that is what I really, really try to. I've devoted some 30 years of my life aiming the light at, into the darkness, the darkest of corners, and just follow the truth wherever it will take me. And so my website, lightonconspiracies.com, and then one of my books is Coup d'etat in slow motion. It is about the assassination of the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, but with all the connection into the Iran-Contras scandal, into all the way back actually to the JFK assassination, the international illegal arms dealing, drug, you name it. It's so entangled, the whole thing. And, well, that's about it. I just want to say that I feel honored to be part of this book project. There's some exceptional people in it. Some of them that haven't been mentioned yet. Sam Gardner is one, Jim Morris is another, and so on. And I just think that this is could be one part of a major step forward when it comes to revealing what is really holding the whole of humanity down in such a horrific way, and most, many, not even being aware of it. So I think this is a time to step up, you know, step into the role and expose what's going on.
All right, very good. We'll have those links up. And also, I believe openmindconference.nl is the direct website for the upcoming event. It's on June 6th and 7th. So do check that out, folks. It's about here in a week. So we'll have this show up before that time, so you can have some opportunity if you're close by to drop by there. But all right, gentlemen, stay with us. We'll return after a short break, and then we'll pick up with more in the second hour. Well, as we pick up in the second hour, folks, we continue down the rabbit hole, if you will, and discuss Paul McCartney and the Beatles. Some very interesting information here that I didn't know about in regards to the speculations concerning his death and replacement in the band. We're going to get into details about not only how, but also why this occurred and the influence during the counterculture of the Beatles themselves. As we proceed in the members' hour, we also talk about other doubles that have been taken out as opposed to installed. Saddam Hussein, a very strange case, and also the fate of CIA asset Osama bin Laden, a.k.a. Tim Osman. We also managed to squeeze in some pretty interesting stuff about Jade Helm together with Jim and Ulla. They have some interesting information to share with us and where this seems to lead as of right now. So don't miss the second hour, ladies and gentlemen, for much more. If you enjoy investigative and controversial radio where the answers lead the way, where we do our utmost to dispel the myth makers and get to the truth, no matter how painful it can be, then you'll enjoy what we have for you on Red Ice Members.com. Close to 1,000 programs on many different subjects that we've been circling and learning more and more and more about over the years. All the details and more information is available for you on redicemembers.com. So go there to sign up and tune in. But before we proceed here, let me tell you about some of our upcoming guests. Mark Hackard, Jonas Deyer, Sophia Smallstorm, Christopher Hell, and Veronica Clark, to name a few. But stay tuned now. We'll be right back after a break with Jim Fetzer and Ulla Damegård. Thank you for listening.
Welcome to The Plain Truth, a show where we go into some of the mysteries, anomalies, and the dirty underbelly of the world around us. I'm your host, Paul, and joining us this week, we have Jim Fesser. Jim, are you there?
Yes, I sure am, Paul. I'm glad to be here with you.
Well, thanks for making time. We appreciate that. You're pretty well known in the conspiracy world, particularly for all your work on the JFK assassination and things like the Zapruder film and so on. And so probably most listeners are fairly well familiar with you. But I thought this time we might try a topic that most people don't think about too much, and that is kind of like looking back on things, what we might have learned, what we did wrong, what we did right, and lessons to draw for the future regarding all of these lies that were being told. So, Jim, do you want to give us any thoughts on how long you've been at it and what you think we can say we've learned and what we might have done right and done wrong over the years?
Sure, glad to, Paul. I got serious about JFK research in 1992 when I discovered that the editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association was abusing his position to attack everyone who'd ever done serious research on the case and to take swipes at Oliver Stone's film JFK, where, while Oliver didn't get everything right, he was a whole lot closer to the truth than anything we ever got from the Warren Commission or the government reinvestigation by the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1977-78. So it troubled me profoundly that someone in his position would be promoting interviews with a pathologist as though they were science, which he would publish in his journal. And when one of the members of the AMA wrote a letter protesting his action, I invited him to collaborate with me on a long article or a book. His name was David W. Mantic. He had both a PhD in physics and an MD and is board certified in radiation oncology, which is the treatment of cancer using X-ray therapy. So he's an expert on the interpretation on X-rays. And we began collaborating then. We're joined by a number of other experts, including a world authority on the human brain, who is also an expert on wound ballistics, physician who actually been present in trauma room one when JFK was more body was brought in and then 2 days later was responsible for the care of his alleged assassin, legendary photo and film analyst, another PhD in physics, this time with expertise in electromagnetism, the properties of light and of images of moving objects. And we, in rather short order, were able to establish that the official autopsy x-rays had been altered to conceal a massive blowout to the back of the head, that the brain in photographs and diagrams in the National Archives could not possibly be the brain of JFK because it's a virtually completely intact brain, whereas JFK had about half his brains blown out in Dealey Plaza. But once they patched up the fist-sized hole in the back of the skull, there was nowhere for those brains to go. And just a mass of indications which grew over time about the alteration of the Zapruder film, which turned out to be a major issue, because it turns out we know now, though we didn't know then, that the driver, William Greer, had actually brought the limousine to a halt, that JFK was hit twice during that halt, that five Secret Service agents dismounted from the Secret Service limousine, surrounded the presidential limousine, and picked up a piece of skull from a young boy who was holding it, threw it back in the trunk. Meanwhile, the motorcycle patrolman to the left rear, who, when hit with the impact of this massive debris from the shot fired from the right front, initially thought he himself had been shot, had dismounted his motorcycle, run in between the two limousines toward the grassy knoll, while another officer on the right had actually motored his bike up the grassy knoll in pursuit until it fell over. But all that is really quite startling and completely inconsistent with the official account, and it was, of course, because the Secret Service bringing the limousine to a halt was such an obvious indication of Secret Service complicity that it had to be taken out. But it's taken years and years to actually piece all this together, and some of these findings I'm telling you now only emerged during the last year, especially in the work of Larry Rivera, who rediscovered the work of a fellow named Fred Newman, who'd actually interviewed four or five of the motorcycle patrolmen and their supervisor in 1971. So those audio tapes provided an invaluable benefit. Now, we have done so much work to establish, you know, that Oswald was framed. He actually turns out to have been standing in the front doorway at the time of the shooting. So not only is he not the lone assassin, he wasn't even one of the shooters. The alteration of the Zapruder film, a hole through the windshield. I mean, it's just dumbfounding to me how these massively documented discoveries, and there are multiple witnesses for most of what I say, and tremendous mountain
of
proof.
Yeah. But Jim, wouldn't you say then that the highest level thing to learn from this is that the authorities, the powers that be, can get away with not one lie, but they can get away with 100 lies?
Well, but of course.
But 9/11 or something, if we're looking, I think we get back to that problem of the big lie, you know, Hitler's thesis of the big lie, right? And so instead of a little lie, they're actually just, you know, flagrantly lying about everything and in a huge way.
Yeah, but I hadn't quite got to that point yet, because what I was going to point out is that on each of these discoveries, we receive massive internal resistance within the JFK research community, which led me to speculate that as many as 50% of the research community was working the other side of the street, where I was corrected by the senior editor for Veterans Today, Gordon Doff, who said actually 90. So a major problem within the community. Turns out that it's overwhelmingly stacked to suppress information about the case. In fact, it would all be very easily exposed, and we've exposed it many times in many ways. I mean, I published 3 books, each of which is sufficient to establish, you know, the basic elements of how the crime was committed. I chaired and co-chaired 5 different national conventions. I have made many different, I've probably given 1,000 interviews on JFK alone. So that the alternative media is well aware, but the major media, the mainstream media, won't touch it. And that's really the ultimate problem when you talk about suppression and maintenance of the big lies, is because the media is basically in the pocket of the government and just won't go there, which of course extends to 9/11 too. I mean, I founded Scholars for 9/11 Truth in December of 2005. We had an amazing year in 2006. The highlight, no doubt, was the American Scholars Conference that Alex Jones organized in Los Angeles in late June. I was on Hannity and Combs both before and after the conference, and subsequently on with O'Reilly. But I also was flown to Athens at the end of the year to appear on a television program that would run 3.5 hours, was broadcast worldwide by satellite, all about 9/11. They'd done a brilliant job of preparing for it. They had all these wonderful video clips. They had a panel of about, 10 different potential interrogators. And they told me going in that ordinarily only a few will say. And I said, no, not today. They'll all speak. And of course, they did all speak. And it was really a marvelous, impressive event, but it was only picked up and reported in, say, I think 9/11 Blogger, which at the time was still a relatively honest forum for exchange, but it would turn out to be corrupted. So that even sources where you would think you'd get a fair shake, like 9/11 Blogger, were taken over and corrupted. And, you know, eventually I reached a point where I'd published a series of articles and was having an exchange with someone there about differentiating between Stephen Jones and myself. And I was explaining that there was an independent test that would be, that would allow us to resolve our differences, where we had a falling out at the end of 2006 because he wanted to stick with nanothermite. And it was obvious to me that was an inadequate explanation of what happened to the Twin Towers. And they bolted, he and Kevin Ryan and others bolted from Scholars, conducted a phony survey of the membership. I mean, it was really quite disgraceful. But now we have 3 major groups, and 2 of them, the Architects and Engineers and the Judy Wood Do group, don't even address who was responsible and why. Now, there's nowhere you can enable the American people to understand what happened by merely focusing on how it was done, especially when, in the case of Judy Wood, it's an exceedingly nebulous view of directed energy weapons. She really even deny she has a theory, as bizarre as that sounds. And then architects and engineers claim it was done using nanothermite. And when I point out, and I did research and published on this with a chemical engineer, that nanothermite doesn't have the explosive capability to blow the buildings apart, they say, well, yes, it was combined with something else. And when I press them on what that something else was, they cannot answer the question, even though they've been the recipients of the largesse of the American people. They've got all kinds of donations and contributions, scholars and those previously affiliated with Veterans Today with whom I've done all my research. We address who was responsible, how it was done, why it was done. We cover all the bases. And I'm just sorry to say that these two other groups appear to be limited hangouts intended to distract the public, where what you must bear in mind is the objective of a disinformation campaign isn't to convince the public one way or another, but create enough uncertainty that everything is believable and nothing is knowable. I mean, these are the most important lessons from the two major cases, and then I can elaborate with many others because I've also done...
No, actually, I think that that's a very important thing, what you just said, is that... The purpose is really to muddy the waters, and I think we've had that in the internet in the last, 10 years or so, where, as you said, nothing is knowable, right? If your figure is correct, that 90% of the people involved in JFK research of any name were, working on the other side, well then, obviously a large percentage of what they're saying is true. Right. But nonetheless, it's mixed in with so much that you can never get anywhere.
Well, here's what you have to understand. The major breakthrough, such as discovering the autopsy x-rays were altered, has been resisted by most members of the JFK research community. I only just about 2 weeks ago interviewed David Mantic on the history of his research on the skull x-rays. On my new video version of The Real Deal, where I had 882 hour shows in the past on Revere Radio when it was purely audio. This year I went to Media Broadcasting Center, went video, and you can find it online, but where David did this completely brilliant job of explaining how he had discovered the x-rays were altered and all that stuff. I knew well because I'd published it in Assassination Science 1998 primarily, and then a brilliant synthesis of the medical evidence in 2000, the first book, Assassination Science, really shattered the case because it gave objective scientific evidence that demonstrated that the government's evidence was fabricated or faked. Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000 gave it the most comprehensive overview, where I have multiple contributors to both. The Assassination Science, I think I had maybe 11, Murder, I think 9, the Great Zapruder Film Hoax 2003, 6. But we're getting into much more technical areas. And the proof is all there. In fact, the case is really essentially resolved, but you have a lot of naysayers who are simply deliberately asserting they can't understand or they don't agree or giving some pseudo argument to oppose it to obfuscate the facts. I mean, I can tell you we know 95% of what happened to JFK, including I've identified 6 of what I take to be 7 shooters. By name, rank, and serial number. I mean, we know this much about it. We know the principal facilitators, who happened to have been Lyndon Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover. Lyndon even sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. I go into all this chapter and verse in my many presentations. And
Hey, Jim.
Yeah.
Jim. I'm originally from D.C., and in my family, it was assumed that Johnson was the man.
And your family was right and very astute. And, that was the belief in Dallas, too, at the time. In fact, Madeline Duncan Brown, with whom he began an affair in 1948, who bore him a child, Stephen, in 1950, and who continued to have a relationship with him right up to the time of the assassination, had a rendezvous with him in the Driscoll Hotel on New Year's Eve, 6 weeks after the shooting, and confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. And he got angry with her and told her the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out, which is as close as we're going to get to a direct confession. from any of the principles. But I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is the suppression. It's not the lack of knowledge. It's not the lack of expertise. I put together the most qualified group of individuals to ever study the case. We went back to the original x-rays and an autopsy report, which turned out to have been revised several times. And, you know, we put the whole case together and rebuilt it from ground up. So if anyone were interested in the truth, they could have done what we did. And they, the government obviously had overwhelmingly more resources, but their role was, in fact, to obfuscate the truth, to not to reveal it. So you know, what you got to understand is that with today's controlled media and since JFK, really things have gotten worse and worse. Investigative journalism has virtually become a lost art. Woodward and Bernstein, you know, you don't find these guys out there today. Take blatant cases like Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing. I have published 30 articles on Sandy Hook. And if anyone wants to go onto YouTube, they can find an overview I created entitled The Real Deal Special Must-See Sandy Hook Update. And on the Boston bombing, The Real Deal Special Must-See Boston Bombing. Nobody died at Sandy Hook. We had all these anomalies about Sandy Hook, including the presence of a sign that said everyone must check in, porta potties. Everyone had name tags on lanyards. Inside the firehouse were boxes of bottled water and pizza cartons. We had parents bringing their children, which would have made no sense at all if this were the site of an actual child shooting massacre. Well, Wolfgang Halbig tried to find out. He's a Florida state trooper, former customs agent, former school principal, now a nationally recognized school safety expert. Try to find out innocuous information like who delivered the porta potties. They wouldn't provide him the information. He's had to go the legal route. And right now, even as we're speaking, he's in the midst of a series of hearings in relation to his FOIA requests that are adducing evidence that confirms several points, including that DHS provided the sign. One of those in a position to know testified under oath that DHS had provided the sign, which, of course, is consistent with our findings, because we have the manual, the FEMA manual for the event. Right in the manual, it says there will be a rehearsal on the 13th. The event will go live on the 14th. Everyone must check in. Refreshments and restrooms will be provided. They couldn't provide him with information about the porta potties because it would have revealed they came in on the 13th when the shooting allegedly took place on the 14th. I mean, it's that bad. You got the whole state of Connecticut involved in this. Lies from the ground up. The school board knows about it. The Newtown Bee knows about it. They participate in the fabrication. The attorney general knows about it. The governor of the state knows about it. He was visited by the attorney general of the United States just about 2.5 weeks before the alleged event. And during a press conference on the day of the supposed shooting, he said that he and the lieutenant governor had been spoken to, that something like this might happen, which led me to speculate. Spoken to? By whom? I mean, there are only really two alternatives. Spoken to, namely that he was told that there was going to be a shooting in a Connecticut school, in which case he ought to have sent out alerts to all the school systems that they take advanced precautions, which he did not do. Or that he'd been spoken to that they were going to take an abandoned school. And I had already determined the school had been closed at least since 2008. And Wolfgang has now obtained confirmation that the last upgrade of the security system was in 2007. And other evidence that confirms this was not an operating school on 14 December 2012. And where, you know, he was told they were going to take an abandoned school, conduct a drill, and present it as a live event in order to promote a gun control agenda. And it turns out he was visited by Eric Holder 2.5 weeks before. Eric Holder's a fanatic about gun control. Obama's a fanatic about gun control. This whole thing was a complete stage fake. They were trying to create a cadre of anti-gun lobbyists with seemingly impeccable credentials, to wit the alleged parents who had lost their children at Sandy Hook. But you know, they were never even allowed to see their children. There was no rush of EMTs. There was no medevac helicopter brought in, no series of ambulances to take the bodies away. According to the official account, they were left in a heap in the classroom until they were taken out in the middle of the night. It's all absurd until you get deeply into it. You start taking it apart. And in the Boston bombing, we had the police on bullhorns calling out, this is a drill. This is a drill. We have the Boston Globe tweeting that a controlled explosion is going to be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities. Another tweet that one will be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, and 1 minute later it goes off in front of the Boston Public Library. After this bomb, and I'm a former artillery officer in the Marine Corps, and I can tell you this was some perfunctory gesture. This wasn't a real explosion. Through the smoke and haze, you can see bodies on the ground that are missing body parts, but there is no blood. The blood only shows up later, and it's fake blood, Hollywood blood. In fact, Nathan Foulkes, who's a Hollywood producer-director, identified one of the key players wearing a cowboy hat. Carlos Arredondo is an actor he cast in one of his own films. He's explained what's going on there is known as hyper-realistic filming, where you try to create a situation that looks as realistic as possible for the benefit, for example, of troops that are going to go into combat, to give them a sense of what they might experience. All the authorities know it's a fraud. All the authorities know it's the fraud. We even have the form they use to hire amputee actors to play these roles. It was all role-playing. No one died at Sandy Hook or at the Boston bombing. And, you know, I have a mountain of proof. In fact, I'm in the midst of filing formal charges against Judy Clark, who was Zoker, I'm told it's actually pronounced Joker, the younger brother, for, you know, throwing away his defense in her opening statement saying he did it. She pled him not guilty. Well, of course he was not guilty. He had nothing to do with it. The boys were framed. And we have a mountain of additional evidence. I've published a more recent article about it entitled, They Didn't Do It. Maret Saranova blows apart the Boston bombing, where Maret was the boy's aunt. And she explained to me, and I quote her extensively from our conversation, how even the footage from the marathon of the two boys was fake. And I asked her how she could prove it, and she started sending me photographs showing that Tamerlan had a beard. And she's got he's lying in bed with his cat. He's got a beard. We have a footage. She sent me a link to working out at a gymnasium with his brother. He's got a beard. In the Boston Marathon footage, he's clean shaven. A friend called him after the bombing and was relieved that he was nowhere in the vicinity. They had dinner that evening. He had a beard. There is a surveillance camera footage with Joker inside and Tamerlan outside. He's got a beard. When the police arrested him, if you don't have a version that's been fuzzied up because they've been doing that, he's got a beard. Even in the body line there with this huge gash in the side, he's got a beard. They even faked the marathon footage. I mean, I'm telling you, this is so outrageous. It nauseates me. I asked a retired law professor who's been both a prosecutor and a defense attorney to look at the case, all the evidence I'd assembled. And he zoomed in on the backpacks. He pointed out that it states right in the FBI investigative report that the two backpacks that exploded were both black nylon backpacks. It states right in the indictment for Zoker in the Boston trial that the backpacks exploded were black nylon backpacks. Well, even in the fake footage of the boys at the marathon, they are not wearing black nylon backpacks. And he observes quite appropriately, that means it wasn't even probable cause to arrest them, much less to bring an indictment or a trial or a conviction. I mean, is that shoddy? Here's one of the most obvious points that the American public seems to misunderstand. We all saw the footage when he was arrested. He was stripped naked. He was put in a vehicle. I could identify him as Tamerlan, but it was nice that his mother and his aunt both identified it as Tamerlan. And then what? A few days later, he shows up dead, and his brother is supposed to have killed him by running him over with his SUV. Listen, he showed up dead after the police had taken him into custody. How is it possible his brother could have killed him when he was in police custody? It is not possible. And we have a witness who reported watching the police drive over him three different times with the black SUV, his own car. The police. This isn't rocket science. If he's arrested and taken into police custody and then he shows up dead, obviously his brother didn't kill him. But Americans are in such a state of semi-stupor that
yeah,
they can't
Jim,
even...
That's the point I want to bring out. I think people are kind of like in watching TV when you like go into this state of a semi-trance. And so they're just lying to us flagrantly. They don't even have to have any basis in reality. And they've been doing it for a while. And so I think we can even go back to things decades ago and wonder if they were real or if they weren't the same BS back then.
Well, it's very obvious if you go back, for example, to the Mura building bombing in Oklahoma City.
That one's obvious, but I mean, even some other ones that people don't think about. I saw a video of the Atlanta Olympic bombing where it looked like there were, acting police and whatever. It looked like a staged.
Well, we've had a lot of these recently, too, in Ferguson. Can you imagine a real body being left in the street for 4 hours? I mean, that's ridiculous. That was a psyop. You had to have an ambulance there. Within 15 minutes, a body would be taken off. How about the guy who was shot at 8 times and hit 5 times? He's not responding to the impact of any bullets. The gun fired by the cop isn't showing any recoil. And when he falls down, he falls down kind of gently so he's not going to harm himself. That's another fabricated case. In Baltimore, they set it up. They actually cut off access to the modes of transportation the students would have taken to get home. The police were already there in riot gear, and they provoked them with mace and tasers. I mean, these are staged events.
Hey, Jim, don't forget those dates in the Baltimore case were like the start of the American Civil War. The first time blood was drawn, the massacre in Baltimore.
That's very, very interesting. No,
April 19th.
That's put when that one together. I like that. I like that, Paul. You're right on top of this.
That is when the bloodshed started. There was a massacre in Baltimore. That's when the actual, Rubicon, I guess, got crossed. If it was a contrived event in the sense of trying to escalate tensions between whites and blacks in the U.S., couldn't pick a more symbolic, place and time than black-white stuff.
That's a very astute observation, Paul. I like that. The big picture, the media is massively controlled. We got like 5 corporations that control 90% of what the American people ever see or hear over the airwaves. We have infiltration of the CIA. Even when before I left Duluth, they brought in a new editor for the Duluth newspaper who was clearly an op. I mean, he came before I retired in 2006 in June. I held a 3-parter at the Marshall Center for the Performing Arts in November, where I did an hour on JFK, an hour on 9/11, an hour on Wellstone. And it was just, they were just chock full of evidence. And when it was over, he came up to me and he asked some silly question about a throwaway line. And he said he had not seen anything at all that had impressed him, about any of these cases. And it just told me all I needed to know about who he was and why he was there in Duluth, which turns out to have had the highest rate of participation in national elections of any community in the country. So he was brought in to tap down any, pangs of liberalism. It was just astounding to me. I mean, I explained all the autopsy evidence of faking of the backyard photographs. I don't think at that point we knew that Oswald actually had been captured in this famous photograph and was actually standing on the front door. But I mean, it was a mountain of proof that he'd been framed, that he hadn't done it. And 9/11, my God, where do you begin? The government told us the buildings collapsed, but they're blowing apart in every direction. All the floors remain stationary. They're being converted into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust. When it's over, in their own footprint, there's nothing there. In contrast that with Building 7, which came down at 5:20 in the afternoon, a bona fide collapse. You see the floor come down. It's not blowing apart in every direction. All the floors come down, and there's a stack of pancakes or debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original, or 5.5 floors in that instance. If you use the same measure, there's sort of been 13 or 14 floors of debris for each of the Twin Towers. But it's not there. I had Father Frank Morales from St. Mark's Episcopal Church, who was a first responder, on my radio show in the past twice. And both times he emphasized that those buildings were destroyed to or even below ground level. Well, That's not a collapse. The buildings weren't collapsing. They were being blown apart from the top down, and the evidence we have amassed indicates that it was done with a very sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes that have a dialable radius that can be directed upward. And interestingly, as a side note, they satisfy the definition Judy Wood has given of a directed energy weapon because they provide much more energy than conventional devices and can be directed. And that appears to be how it was done. So in a technical sense, she was right. It was done using dews, just not the way she has claimed, where she's never really been able to substantiate it, because any evidence she claims can only be explained by dews, can be explained by the sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, and much of the evidence we can explain she can't, including the U.S. Geological Survey dust samples from all over Manhattan, which include all kinds of elements that would only be present if this had been a nuclear event, including barium, strontium, lanthanum, lithium, uranium, tritium, and all that. I mean, I've published many articles about this, which are, I had a falling out with a senior editor of Veterans Today, who I mentioned before, Gordon Duff. This happened about 6 weeks ago, when he trashed an article that another writer, who was like myself, a former Marine, had written about Jade Helm, raising some rather innocuous questions. And he put in this massive editor's note saying this article was unsourced, uninformed, and that he knew from his own sources this was a routine training drill involving National Guard, just 1,200 troops. So I looked into it, and I knew what Gordon was doing was completely wrong. So I published an article in which I faulted him for it and elaborated more of the reasons how we know that this is not an ordinary training op. He put on another editor's note that was even twice as long and more vicious than he had before, but it still got 600 reads in the first hour. And I told my wife, this is going to go to number one. Well, Gordon obviously saw the handwriting on the wall, so he deleted my article. That night, I went on the air and talked about it with a fellow named Stu Webb, who's a very well-known federal whistleblower whose work has initiated 5 or 6 congressional hearings into major scandals, and whom Gordon had fired just a couple of weeks before when I was on the air with him, with another Veterans Day writer at the time who's now retired by the name of Preston James. And I thought it was just stunning he'd done that in the first place. But there I went on with Stu to talk about all this, and the next morning I discovered that Gordon had taken me out of Veterans Today, where I'd published 150 articles. And when 3 weeks later he still had my name on the masthead, Paul, I told him, isn't it time to take my name off the masthead? And he deleted the rest of my articles that were there, all 150.
Jim, you're the guy who mentioned that figure of 90%.
I know. Well, it was Gordon who said it to me.
Yes,
isn't
I know.
Isn't that fascinating? See, that's another nice point. I mean, Gordon has actually gone on the air and said how 30%, he's made claims like 30% of what is published in Veterans Today is false, and that 40% of what he writes is not right. I've always interpreted that as meaning, and I sought to apologize for him for having said that by explaining that, well, he just knows so much, he can't say everything he knows without being in serious jeopardy. Today, however, I'm convinced he was using me to build up the credibility of Veterans Today, and that was a website designed to contain the veteran community from getting upset from events like Jade Helm. Because, Paul, we know there are no domestic terrorists. We've been fed all this garbage about the necessity for this NSA surveillance. Well, the Senate Committee on Homeland Security released its own report on 3 October 2012, based upon its review of 680 studies from fusion centers, where fusion centers merge federal, state, and local anti-terrorist activity, gathered between 2009 and 2010. And in those 680 reports from all over the country, Paul, they found not a single example, not a single instance of domestic terrorist activity, nor any case in which a fusion center had prevented a terrorist action from taking place. And today, of course, we have confirmation from this fellow, David Steele, who's a former CIA military intelligence operative, that every terrorist act since 9/11, he makes one exception. I'll have to look up what it is he thinks is the exception, has been brought to his compliments of our own government, especially, may I say, the FBI.
Well, that's their job. They're to nurture enemies of the state. And they're not real, of course. They have to find
bizarre,
some Somalian immigrant or something who couldn't create, a bunch of fireworks if you paid him. So
it's
the
bizarre.
FBI has to buy the fireworks and put them together.
It's bizarre,
it's just
because
a joke.
The FBI spends more time covering up crimes or committing them. I mean, an interesting case is Sarinov's friend down in Florida. Five agents went to question him. He was very worried they were coming. He told his friends he thought they were going to kill him. And toward the end of the interview, four of them left and one stayed behind, who later would claim he'd lunged at him with a knife. He shot him five times and killed him. Like the way the FBI operates, they always have two agents together, one to ask the questions, the other to take notes. So leaving one behind was an obvious setup. This was rigged. They murdered him just as he said they were going to. And this is not a solitary case. I mean, look back on the Boston bombing. The police know. The Boston Globe knows. The defense attorney knows. The prosecutor knows. The judge knows. Everyone knows that this is a show trial. This is phony, that they didn't do it. In fact, a representative of the defense team even traveled to Eastern Europe and spoke with members of the family and admitted they knew they weren't guilty, but they were under tremendous pressure to find him guilty. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Yes, but I think that what this shows, besides how corrupt the system is that the power of the media means that they can just hoodwink the masses. And like I was saying earlier, we could probably revisit some things like this is kind of controversial, but let's take the Apollo moon landing. Jim, let me just finish, because I have like a personal and then family thing as well involved in that, rockets and all. I would say that let's say that they went to the moon, and but if you were involved in the system, you're a presidential advisor, you're a military advisor, whatever. Are you going to want something that has a high chance of going wrong to be shown on live TV? You know, can you imagine if they're stuck there on the moon, their oxygen supply is running out, and they're all going to die, and everybody around the world is going to get to watch it? Would you allow that? That would be very risky. You know? In other words, what I'm saying is, if you could fake it, wouldn't it be a much safer way to go?
Paul, it wasn't. It wasn't scientifically or technically possible to go to the moon. Ironically, I've just published a book, a brand new book, 363 pages. I've got 13 contributors. It's entitled, "And I Suppose We Didn't Go to the Moon Either."
Yes, that I saw the title of that. I haven't.
I have 100 pages, four contributors about the moon landing. I have 100 pages, four contributors about Paul McCartney, who, while it has heretofore been, you know, a subject of great discussion within a certain community of Beatles fans, known as PID, Paul is Dead, produces forensic evidence. Actually, it was done by two Italian scientists. So we're talking about two different people before and after 1966. They have different teeth, different palates. Their skulls are different sizes, different shapes. Their ears are different. They're even different heights. So Paul actually was replaced. The point I make about this is, if you could replace the most highly visible, the most closely scrutinized figure in the world, Paul McCartney, and the world not appreciate what happened, you could replace anyone. So I have 25 pages on Saddam Hussein. We hung a double, not Saddam. I have 25 pages on Osama, who actually died in Afghanistan on or about 15 December 2001. He wasn't. He was miraculously resurrected so he could die again in Pakistan in 10 years later to benefit the political agenda of Barack Obama. And then 50 pages on the Holocaust, because we have new scientific research, especially represented by the brilliant book of Nicholas Kohlstrom entitled Breaking the Spell, that reveals that the key elements of the Holocaust narrative are unsustainable. The idea that 6 million Jews were gassed to death using Zyklon B. I mean, it turns out that Zyklon B is a form of cyanide. And anyone who had been gassed to death by cyanide, their body would turn pink. But we don't have any reports of pink bodies. And the walls of the chambers, because of the interaction between the cyanide and the elements in the walls, would turn blue. But the only chambers whose walls turned blue were ones used for delousing, because they were using a lot of Zyklon B to kill body lice to prevent the spread of typhus and other diseases in the camps. It turns out that the 6 million has no historical or empirical foundation whatsoever, that there are 236 allusions to 6 million Jews in dire straits or in fear of the loss of their lives that begin in 1890. 236 references all before the Nuremberg tribunals, Paul. And where the best data we have actually comes from the International Committee of the Red Cross, that was keeping meticulous records about who died, their ages, and other aspects of their identity, which they updated in 1993. And the latest data they had showed 296,081 died in all the camps combined. More Catholics than Jews died at Auschwitz.
No, that's not surprising. I mean, to me, though, the real thing is the war was in Eastern Europe, and millions of people died for all kinds of reasons, like starvation and desperation, you know.
Are you going to tell me, Paul, that you've never been told that 6 million Jews were gassed to death? That these camps?
I've heard that. Yes, I have heard that. But on the other hand,
get this.
I'm saying that just that we could separate the fact that millions of people died for all kinds of reasons.
Of course.
And in other words, that 6 million figure is more of a political agenda thing.
No, it's actually theological. It appears.
Yeah, I know. It's a theological thing from before. It's got some, you know, some whatever.
It appears to derive
or whatever kind of thing.
It appears to derive from a disputed passage in Leviticus that's been interpreted as meaning that the chosen people cannot return to the promised land until they're minus 6 million who have been consumed in the flame. But even the number has to be interpolated because there was no symbol or sign for 6 million in the original language. So the whole thing. It's really been multiple motives to deflect attention from the Allied responsibility for a lot of starvation in the camps, which could not be resupplied after the Allies did this massive bombing of the German cities and even interdicted the railroad lines. So it wasn't that Hitler had the deliberate policy of exterminating the Jews. No document, no source for that has ever been revealed, and in fact, his closest aides were astonished to hear this during the Nuremberg Tribunal because they had never had any idea such a thing was going on for the simple reason that it wasn't going on. And, you know, I mean, this is just incredible stuff.
Well, but again, Jim, it's just because we've been constantly lied to forever, and yep. The TV has made it so that they've really got us in their spell. It's truly like they're magicians with Hollywood or something.
Well, except
they've
that you're,
got people hypnotized. That's all.
It's interesting you mention Hollywood because Hollywood has done so much to perpetuate the official narrative of the Holocaust. Schindler's List, The Reader, Piano, all these kinds of films. Sophie's Choice, you know, all heart-wrenching, heart-tugging. It's just that they're not based upon historical fact. And the motive appears to have been to allow the Zionists who believe in the twin theses of Jewish superiority plus a dubious entitlement to all the lands of the Middle East from the Tigris-Euphrates to the Nile, Paul.
Yes, we know.
are able to play on a Western sense of guilt to gain deference to Israel for this, that, and the other. I mean, are you aware that Cynthia McKinney has revealed that when a new member of Congress arrives in Washington, they are presented with the request to sign a pledge to put the interests of Israel above the interests of the United States? And if you don't do that in your next election, you face a heavily financed candidate and a run out of Congress, which is what happened to her.
Well, it's good to know that somebody there has some principles.
That's right. That's right.
They may be bad, but at least they have.
Well, Cynthia, I'm talking sure about Cynthia. Cynthia McKinney is the one who has the principles.
Yes, I know. I agree. And I think she is worthy of our respect. Yeah. Well, obviously, though, when you talk about the Holocaust, then I think you have to get into the whole point, though, with this is we're being lied to in such a massive way. And so the whole World War II narrative is full of, you know, dramatic problems. I mean, we could just start like anywhere. Auschwitz, I think you mentioned. Okay. Auschwitz used more electricity than Berlin, which was the sixth largest city on earth at the time. Why is that? Well, it was an industrial plant, obviously. But a lot of people think it's where they did their uranium processing, which is tremendously electricity intensive. And you see what I'm saying? You get into all kinds of messy questions that everybody wanted to cover up.
I even published a map of Auschwitz in the book. Mm-hmm. And it has all kinds of facilities that are inconsistent with this being a center for extermination. It includes a hospital with OBGYN facilities. It includes a concert hall for symphonies, a woodworking shop where you could make furniture and other objects. Paul had even had a brothel. Now, I put that right in the book. And on the back cover, Paul, you'll love this. On the back cover, I put a photograph of the British soccer team at Auschwitz with a caption. What? You didn't know there was a UK soccer team at Auschwitz? And I tell you, they're all looking very fit. They're looking very healthy. And we have all kinds of photographs from the release at the various camps of the children and so forth. And they're actually well fed. They look healthy. They're not all emaciated. Some were, of course, and as you observe, in the Eastern Front, there was a great deal of death and destruction. And I'm not denying that millions, including millions of Jews died during World War II. It was a god-awful mess. But I'm just saying that the official narrative we've been given of 6 million Jews having been gassed to death using Zyklon B is not sustainable. It's false. It's not based on history or fact. And it's inconsistent with laws of science. Now, you see, Nick's an historian of science, and I'm a philosopher of science. I've published extensively on scientific reasoning, scientific theories, scientific explanation, scientific laws, which incidentally cannot be violated and cannot be changed. So we're talking here about laws of biochemistry, bodies turning pink when they're put to death using cyanide, laws of material science, walls turning blue when the cyanide interacts with the elements in the walls. These can't be violated and can't be changed. And the evidence is simply overwhelming. And Nick produces a mountain of it in his book, Breaking the Spell. But there's a wonderful 50 pages about the Holocaust by four different authors that I would suggest. If you actually want to understand the Holocaust, you could not do better than reading those 50 pages.
Well, I will. I haven't read them yet. But the point I want to make is there are going to be a lot of listeners who will say, but why? Okay, ignoring theological issues with the number 6 million and stuff like that, they're going to say, okay, why? And I'm trying to say there are practical reasons for those who won the war, and even Germany, and also the Soviets, for accepting some kind of lie. It was convenient for them. They don't want to talk about Germany's nuclear program, for example. It justified, of course, creating Israel. Anyway, we could go on. There are a lot of reasons. And now, with the laws in Europe or Germany, you can't investigate. Let's say, Jim, let's say that you know somebody who's a scientist, and he says, you know, I want to go check and see if there are any traces of, nuclear material there. Good luck. You'll be arrested. You won't get clean. There's no way, you can't. You see, it's a control paradigm is what I'm saying. They create these, and it turns everybody off. This is the second thing. Even this discussion we're having now, it turns a lot of people off. They just don't want to hear about the Holocaust.
Right. They don't want to hear something that is inconvenient or conflicts with their deeply held beliefs, even if their deeply held beliefs are false, provably false, not scientifically sustainable. I have very little patience for this attitude, Paul. Either you care about the truth or you don't. If you don't care about the truth, then don't take a stand on anything because you don't know. You don't know. My attitude has always been, if the Holocaust was real, then research would sustain it. And if it is not, the world deserves to know. Well, the answer, it turns out, rather to my surprise, is it is not. And the world deserves to know.
Yes, yes. Well, anyway, though, I think the more you look into these various conspiracies, the more I think you realize that they use the big lie. They hoodwink us relentlessly, and the key element is TV. They've just got people in a trance. They're just literally in a trance.
Let me say a few words about the word conspiracy and so forth. The fact is that conspiracy is the most commonly prosecuted crime in the United States. Conspiracy to defraud, conspiracy to commit burglary, conspiracy for this. It is the most commonly prosecuted crime in the United States. Now, the CIA had a problem. There were too many critics who were dismembering the Warren report, so they wanted to figure out a way that they could, in a short, simple phrase, dismiss them, belittle them, and imply that they don't deserve to be taken seriously. And that led them to contrive the phrase conspiracy theorists. So it actually turns out, Paul, that people who are qualified or characterized as conspiracy theorists today are critics of the government. That's who they are. They aren't trying to weave some theory out of whole cloth. They aren't fantasizers. They aren't speculators. They're people who have studied the evidence and find what the government has told us does not add up. I have done that with JFK. I've done that with 9/11. I've done that with Wellstone. I've done that with Sandy Hook. I've done that with the Boston bombing. And now I'm doing it with Jade Helm. And frankly, I'm sick of having a government that does nothing but lie to the people. You're absolutely right that the major media has an enormous role here and responsibility. I believe it was Jefferson who was asked, would he prefer a government without newspapers or newspapers without a government, where he expressed a preference for the latter over the former. But he had no idea, could not have envisioned newspapers as corrupt as they are today. There's more truth in Pravda than you can find in the New York Times. It's absolutely outrageous. The New York Times was an implementer, instigator, promoter of the attack on Iraq, for which there was no justification whatsoever. We have destabilized the Middle East. We've created chaos there, which was easily predictable to anyone who is familiar with the history of the Middle East, and was done to benefit Israel. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons, most of whom were dual U.S.-Israeli citizens and the Mossad. The idea was to transform American foreign policy from one in which we never attacked any nation that hadn't attacked us first, at least officially, to one in which we became an aggressor nation to deconstruct the modern Arab state that served as a counterbalance to Israel's domination of the Middle East. That's why we're there. That's why we're there then. That's why we're there today. All this business about ISIS is about as much malarkey as ever come up. We have a Defense Intelligence Agency documents now showing that they allowed ISIS to be created to isolate Syria, that we aren't attacking ISIS. We're actually bombing the infrastructure of Syria to weaken Assad. The Iraqi army has done more to defeat ISIS than the American military put together. They shot down two UK cargo planes providing supplies to ISIS about a month ago. And then a week later, they shot down two U.S. helicopters providing supplies to ISIS. Two American generals advise ISIS. It's known in Washington as John McCain's army. I'm sick of this. I'm sick of living in a country that's so despicable, that is so hypocritical. I am standing my ground and doing my best to straighten it out by bringing as much truth as I possibly can to the American people. But, Paul, we're in a despicable state. The government, our nation, has lost its way. We no longer stand for truth and democracy. We stand for lies and hypocrisy.
Yes, I agree. And for some reason, a lot of people can't see the obvious rat in things like ISIS. I mean, can you imagine? They show you on TV some videos of like 3,000 brand new Toyota trucks.
I know.
Right? Painted and everything, you know? It's like they just found them? Really?
It's ridiculous. And all the fake beheadings? I mean, it's ridiculous. Done on a soundstage in Israel. John McCain even flew to Syria and was photographed with a leader of ISIS who, it appears, is a Mossad agent. I mean, that's how bad it is.
Well, they don't try to hide it. That's the other thing, is that at least, Jim, for you and me, we can look into this stuff a fair degree, because they no longer hide things. They don't care.
Yeah, but Paul, you know, I don't know how much you've looked into Jade Helm, but I'm telling you, something very, very bad is going on in this country. They have this is a massive operation. We have hundreds of Americans who are have taken photographs, videos, and all that. Massive movements of equipment. As a former Marine Corps officer,
Jim, here's my question for you. Okay, let me play devil's advocate. Okay, I live outside the U.S. To me, the U.S. is already a police state. They don't have to clamp down, and the only thing left is they need to nationalize the police. Okay.
Well, I think that's why we had all the shootings, Paul.
That's what the shootings are all about.
Yeah, I think so that Al Sharpton, who in many ways is a good man, would lead a march to nationalize the police, which is a giant step toward fascism. I agree completely.
But the point is that Jade Helm, they are doing drills, and they have been doing all kinds of drills all the time for 10, 15 years now.
This is not a drill, Paul. They're remodeling the Walmarts. We got five Walmarts closed. They're going to be command and control centers. They're going to be detainee processing centers. They're putting up 8 and 9 foot high fences. They're covering over the windows with black plastic so you can't see what's going on. They're ripping up the floors. A friend who's more expert on this than I says they're laying down arrays of electrodes so they can shock the detainees' feet when they're incarcerated in a cell and, you know, inflict pain or even unconsciousness or even cause their death. We have a report from a construction worker saying he is very uneasy about what's going on inside the Walmart because it looks to him like they're putting up four guard towers. Those are enormous buildings. One Walmart in Florida has had the doors reinforced with blast resistant doors. That costs $100,000 to $200,000. This is not a drill, Paul. And I just learned today that Sam Walton, who founded Walmart, was responsible for running prisoner of war or Japanese detainee facility.
Well, what did you think? That's what Walmart is. It's a homeland security complex kind of company, and it has.
Well, I don't know how long you've known that, but I haven't known there were special arrangements between Walmart and FEMA until about the last 6 or 8 weeks. So, you know, if you have known that all along, you were ahead of me on that. But I'll tell you, I've done show
well,
after
no
show.
Well, I won't say no, and I'll say that was the rumor. How about I put it that way? That is what people talked about, you know, that, well, first of all, look, if a company grows the way Walmart did, you know, you gotta think that there's some money behind it. When a company goes and just grows and grows and grows dramatically, okay, in a low margin business, right? Do you think that's really a natural phenomenon, or is it that there's an interest behind it? There's money laundering, there's stock fraud, you know what I mean? There are all kinds of things going on. And so anyway, that's an additional angle to that.
Well, but, Paul, I think you're a very sophisticated and perceptive guy who has his act together and understands a whole lot of things that most Americans do not. And for that, I compliment you, and I appreciate very much being featured on your show. I would say those who want to learn more about Jade Helm, for example, should track down my new video show. It's on video this year, where I have about 60 different video programs, at least a half a dozen of which are devoted to Jade Helm, on MBC, Media Broadcasting Center, the show called The Real Deal. If you go online and look for MBC, The Real Deal, you'll find the archives. You'll find all 60 shows. And watch the last half a dozen or eight or so dealing with Jade Helm. I also do this thing with Kevin Barrett called False Flag Weekly News on No Lies Radio, where he and I have been going at it for the last 6 weeks or so because he's a skeptic. He thinks all this is just to lead the alternative media into making a fool out of itself over Jade Helm. But I have done overwhelmingly more research on this than has he, and I'm just sorry I've been unable to get him to see the light about this, because I regard Jade Helm as the greatest threat to freedom and democracy in the history of the United States.
Well, that's pretty dramatic. Well, anyway, Jim, thanks for coming. I know you've got to run, so let's
yeah,
let's
Paul,
call it
coincidentally,
a wrap here.
Right, coincidentally, my own show is about to start, so
so now you can
I
jump
a,
right in. Yeah,
I have
exactly.
A particularly good guest, by the way. His name is Scott Bennett. If you look him up, he's a PsyOps guy who knows all about what's going on here. So we're going to have an extensive 2-hour conversation. That's going to be
okay.
The perfect extension of this, Paul. I can't thank you enough. Okay.
Okay. Thanks, Jim. That's
real
it,
pleasure.
Folks. It's a wrap.